It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, more on the ramifications of recent police killings of two unarmed black men. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. We just scratched the surface on our Encounter show last week when we discussed the reasons for and reaction to a grand jury's decision not to charge a white police officer in the death of Eric Garner, an unarmed African-American man in New York. Unlike the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, Garner's death at the hands of police officer Daniel Pantaleo was captured by a pedestrian on his smartphone video recorder. Protests, both peaceful and some confrontational, erupted around the country, spearheaded in many cases by university students outraged at what is perceived of as an excessive use of force by local police and the disproportionate targeting of minorities. On this edition of Encounter, we will review the significance of the nationwide protests, examine the grand jury process, the incidence of racial profiling, the need for reforms in recruitment and training of local law enforcement officers, and the role of the federal government, and also to what extent the use of body cameras can make a difference regarding transparency and accountability. Well, for more on next steps in implementing reforms and increasing scrutiny of police tactics, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Dr. Elsie Scott is Howard University's founding director of the Ron W. Walters Leadership and Public Policy Center. Prior to joining Howard University, Elsie Scott was president of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, executive director of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and deputy commissioner of training for the New York City Police Department. And Malik Aziz, he's deputy chief for the Dallas, Texas Police Department and chairman of the National Black Police Association. Well, Elsie Scott joins me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Chairman Malik Aziz joins us by phone from his headquarters in Dallas, Texas. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Elsie Scott, let me begin with you here in the studio. Big question. What do you think are the biggest issues now that we need to tackle and lessons possibly learned in the aftermath of the death of these two men? And we could also add the killing of the 12-year-old youth in Cleveland, Ohio.
Right. There are a lot of issues that need to be resolved. Law enforcement has been somewhat ignored except for Homeland Security over the last 10 to 12 years, and we have not focused on law enforcement in the community. And I think this gives us an opportunity to now look at the relationships between local police and the community, gives us an opportunity to look at how do we select, how do we recruit, because we haven't really focused a lot on whether police departments represent the communities that they serve. When we look at demographics, at one time, records were being kept of how many black police officers, how many Hispanic police officers there were in police departments, and we got away from that. And so I think it's time for us to go back and see, do our police departments represent our communities? And then it gives us an opportunity to look at the grand jury system, you know, because our prosecutors too powerful? And how do we deal with peaceful protesters in this country?
Indeed. Well, there's a lot to chew on, and I'm going to turn to you now, Malik Aziz in Dallas, Texas, chairman of the National Black Police Association. From your perspective as a law enforcement officer, what lessons do you take from the protests in the aftermath of the deaths of these men at the hands of white police officers, and what are the biggest issues we must tackle in the days ahead?
I'd like to agree with several points that Dr. Scott stated. I think from our point of view, from the National Black Police Association, which, you know, we've been at the forefront of this battle since before the 1970s, but established in 1972, even with a platform against police brutality, but the first one with the community engagement, community policing philosophy. I think police reform is definitely at the top of the list dealing with tactics and strategies. Some of those things have been called into question with the Michael Brown case and Eric Garner and Tamir Rice recently, but there are hundreds of other cases did not get national media acclaim or even local media attention. So it's going to bring that back into focus, as we've seen in the past few days with hearings in Washington. Grand juries are going to have to be more transparent in what they do and how they get information out, as we've seen in Michael Brown's case with the releasing of transcripts, and then in Eric Garner's case, still a super secretive proceeding, which is clearly problematic. Third is the overall community engagement. Community engagement has to be made on a real sincere level that is built around transparency, trust, accountability, and responsibility. Four, as Dr. Scott said, diversity in recruiting is a must. You can't have a police department, even if it's 50 people, with three people who are African-American, yet in a city that is 65% to 70% black. This happens all across the United States, and even more so, command, diversifying a department is one thing, but if you don't see minorities or diverse demographics inside the command, then we're still failing. And lastly, a national clearinghouse. The government keeps stats on just about everything you can imagine. I read once where they was talking about shark attacks, but yet we don't have stats on diversity. We don't have stats on how many police officers are involved in deadly encounters or in custody deaths. So this right here is an atrocity and something that is so vital to our interaction in communities with authority, and a policeman being one of the most visible forms of the government, yet we don't even keep statistics on that. We keep statistics on crime, but not when a person dies. So I think those issues are echoing some of the things that Dr. Scott said. I'm in full agreement, but from our point of view, we need to address those issues, and that's just scratching the surface.
Indeed. Well, let me turn back to Elsie Scott, and let's drill down. For example, you talked about police reforms and how we need to get away from this national security paradigm. Not that that's not important, but since 9/11, we've seen an increased militarization of local police forces. Mm-hmm. We're seeing now the negative consequences and the need for better local police forces, a more diverse makeup, and, you know, a less aggressive attitude vis-a-vis the community. What do you see going forward, how this may change? Are we going to see now some kind of impetus in local police departments as a result of these more high-profile cases?
I think that we had a period where we were very much focused on community policing, and people like me were recruited to come into police departments to help police officers understand policing communities, especially policing communities of color. And then, as I mentioned earlier, after September 11th, all of the money that was tapped for police departments coming from the national government focused on weaponry and fighting the enemy within and without, but primarily looking at terrorism. So I think we have to come back to this whole thing of community policing. We had a project with the Justice Department at one point called Hiring in the Spirit of Service. We recruit people who want to serve, and, you know, police departments protect and serve, but we put a lot of emphasis on the protection as it relates to military equipment, but less on serving the community and recognizing that most people in the community are law-abiding citizens. There's a need to apprehend the criminals, but there's also a need to work with the law-abiding people in the community. So I think the fact that the President of the United States has appointed a task force to look at this is a good step in the right direction. And you can look back after the 1960s riots, when President Lyndon Johnson appointed the Kerner Commission, and that commission did issue a report, and there were a lot of reforms made in law enforcement. So I'm hoping this time that this commission will be given some of the power and authority, and that we will have things coming out of this commission that will help to reform policing and bring it back to more of an emphasis on community policing.
Turning back to you, Malik Aziz, chairman of the National Black Police Association in Dallas, Texas, do you see a way that we could get back to community policing in terms of recruitment? I mean, we look at the gentleman who killed this teenager in Cleveland, this 12-year-old boy with a BB gun, thinking he had a real gun. Well, as I have read, he shouldn't have been hired in the first place. He was not deemed adequate in many ways. And how did the Cleveland Police Department hire this person? So that's one question. And then in terms of diversity, are we learning from what we've witnessed? And are we going to go into a different direction as a result of perhaps this task force that President Obama has organized?
I believe we're at a turning point in policing. And this marks the third turning point in the last 30 years or so. Rodney King was a turning point in policing. 9-1-1 was a turning point in policing. Michael Brown, Ferguson, or New York City is a turning point in policing. When we look back, when community policing was at the forefront and COPS programs were in effect and police departments were hiring officers specifically to deal with especially diverse communities, and then 911 came, and then after 911, we focused on heavy weaponry, and we got further away from the funds given to helping communities get along as far as establishing police athletic leagues and activity leagues or being involved in reading and mentoring programs, understanding that rehab and reentry were points that we were going to have to deal with if we wanted safer communities, and we backed up from that. So in police departments that could only get funds to do those kind of things, we was going to hold them accountable for how they did things. And you see in Ferguson, it wasn't the militarization of the police department that was a failure. It was the lack of ability to deploy resources that was the failure. So the governmental 1033 programs come under fire, and some of those things are much needed. I would be more focused on how you deploy them. You know, you give boys toys and they play with them, so we have to hold them accountable. One point that you did make about these officers in Cleveland, and I looked at it and I said, just bad tactics and bad policing. In the end result, a person with a gun will be most likely to be met with some kind of force, a failure in the 911 system, a failure in the dispatch system, and a failure in training. And these kind of officers who become identified later, the states have to put in laws and with their licensing agencies that these police officers who get fired or go from department to department with bad records, that we understand who they are and we stop their employment. It's always been police departments that fail to look at people who look like them but over-scrutinize people of different diversities and demographics. And so we're going to have to address those things, and that's good what the president is doing with the task force, and I hope he would include grassroots organizations like ours. But House Resolution 1447 is a big step in the right direction for bringing us back to accountability for these police departments.
So House Resolution 1447 is the legislation that authorizes the task force?
Well, House Resolution 1447 is dealing with the Death in Custody Reporting Act. That's one of the first steps. The task force, with a daunting task of trying to come up with a better community policing philosophy and addressing some of the tactics and strategies that we use and trying to report back to the president. But I would hope that grassroots organizations play a major part in that kind of task force, especially organizations who have been dealing with police brutality, with controversial issues that set us apart and aside from other labor and management organizations, that we must have a voice at the table and not just police chiefs or executives of police department, the same people that you entrust now to actually deploy and deliver a reasonable community engagement, or most of the same people who are on this task force right on. So I hope that in the future, grassroots organization and people who have right-thinking minds and progressive attitudes, such as Dr. Scott, their ability would be included in such a task force, because if the MBPA, who's been fighting these issues and bringing them to the forefront for 40-plus years, if they're not included, then it doesn't bring me into a great hope that the outcome would be beneficial for communities of diversity or demographics inside of police departments or otherwise.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Elsie Scott. She's Howard University's founding director of the Ron Walters Leadership and Public Policy Center, and Malik Aziz, from whom you just heard. He's deputy chief for the Dallas, Texas Police Department and chairman of the National Black Police Association. I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the need for nationwide reforms in community policing in the aftermath of the deaths of two black men at the hands of white police officers. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And please send us feedback to encounter@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a new listener, Baltazar K. Balkas. He's a native of Guinea-Bissau, living in Lisbon. Obrigada pelo seu apoio. Well, back to you, Elsie Scott. What about this resort to the use of deadly force? It seemed, again, from an observer's point of view, that in both the Ferguson case and Eric Garner in particular, that the resort to the use of deadly force seemed a bit precipitous. Why this type of aggression, particularly in the Eric Garner case in New York, the gentleman selling untaxed cigarettes who died as a result of an apparent chokehold, why this aggressive approach vis-a-vis what are look like misdemeanors and not really like threatening crimes?
One thing we have not talked about that we've talked around is the whole issue of racism in the U.S., that there seems to be perception on the part of some white officers of a black man being a threat. If you read the comments from Officer Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri, he referred to Michael Brown as seeming like a demon, and he referred to, you know, his size and feeling threatened by him. And so I think that's a problem we have in this country, is this whole fear that every black man in these types of situations has a weapon and that he's a threat to police officers. So when we talk about reforming the police system in the U.S., we have to talk about the elephant that's in the room, and that's the whole thing of the perception of African-American men in this country.
Turning back to you, Malika Aziz, I think that's a very good point. And I was going to bring that up, but I think it's very appropriate. To what extent is racial profiling a part of the problem and perhaps leads some police officers, white police officers in particular, to resort to the use of deadly force more quickly, perhaps vis-a-vis black men? And again, this particular case of Eric Garner, again, I'm not trying to diminish any kind of crime he was in the process of committing, but why this aggressive behavior? Is it mostly a racial issue, discrimination against minorities and this fear, or are there other factors?
I think it's very broad, and it's a lot of things that go into the mix of how police do police communities of diversity. When you look at the overall culture, minority neighborhoods, police chiefs who have no direction, and police departments who have a lack of understanding of diverse communities tend to over-police those communities. And when I say over-police, it goes back into these are all criminals. That's cultural. They don't know enough about it, which then relates us to police departments who fail to diversify or fail to hire the right people and fail to have a community engagement, a true community engagements. I won't make a sweeping indictment of any one particular race because I've seen white police officers, because you don't have to be black to police a black area, but all you have to do is care. And I've seen many white police officers and Latino police officers who care just as much as black officers. And I've seen some black officers who are very lost in their policing philosophy and to policing communities of diversity, and some of them in which they came from. So I think in the great scheme of things and how we look at what will happen in our neighborhoods, we have to understand that police officers in this fixing broken windows, New York City philosophy that came out of that, this is Eric Garner, that we will do a type of broken window style policing and fix it from people who are doing misdemeanors on the street. And that calls into question just how much you will over-police a community based on what the community is asking for and then the type of service that you plan on delivering. Studies have shown that black communities, they want a community free of crime. They want a progressive community, one that has jobs and a vibrant lifestyle just as anybody else. But what they don't want is to be over-policed and their neighborhoods to be made a police state and everybody viewed as a criminal.
Indeed. Well, we have just a few minutes left and a lot more to talk about. Back to you, Elsie Scott, to talk about the grand jury process very briefly. We note that in the last two high-profile cases, Michael Brown and more recently Eric Garner, the grand juries decided not to indict the two white police officers. Talk about the grand jury system and to what extent this may or may not change as a result of these two particular high-profile cases. And I just note for our audience that grand juries have to decide if there is enough evidence to bring a case to trial. They do not determine whether or not someone is guilty or innocent. But in these two cases, the perception is that the grand juries are likely to trust police more. There's some sort of a benefit of the doubt.
Well, you can't talk about the grand jury process unless you also talk about the role of the prosecutor in the United States. That it has often been said that a good prosecutor can convict a ham sandwich. And so I think a lot of people feel like once a prosecutor presents a case to the grand jury, if the prosecutor wants an indictment. The prosecutor will present it in such a way that he or she will get an indictment. And they feel like the prosecutors in these cases did not want the person indicted. I think in this country, we like to give police officers the benefit of the doubt because we understand the hazards of that position. So when we look at the grand jury system in this country, we also have to look at who serves on grand juries and the whole tie this into voting, because the way you get selected is you have to be a registered voter. Mm. And so more people from these poor communities need to get registered to vote so that they will be part of the pool and so that their voice will be heard. And then once they get called for jury duty, they need to stop finding ways to avoid the jury, because I have sat in the jury room and people applauded about how they were going to answer the questions to get off of serving in the jury. And then we come back and we complain about the decision. So I think, you know, there are a number of issues here, but, you know, prosecutions and the way cases are presented, who serves on grand jury, the whole secrecy of the grand jury process, and whether we should have special prosecutors to handle these types of cases.
Turning back to you, Malik Aziz, to comment on the grand jury system. Now, I note also that some people are calling for special prosecutors to preside over grand juries in cases against police officers for the reasons that Elsie Scott mentioned. Others are calling for the complete elimination of the whole grand jury system. What are your views as chairman of the National Black Police Association and in law enforcement about this grand jury system?
I think Dr. Scott couldn't have said it any better. I will say this. It showed us just how broken the grand jury system is, especially in Eric Garner's case, that making a case for cameras and things like that and told the world that they didn't see what they thought they saw. I think we have to start with the police investigating their own. There is wide understanding that says police officers no longer can investigate their own because a lack of giving out the information, and that to prosecutors who will present this information to a grand jury, that they'll present it in a way in which the police department gave it to them, because it's a very difficult and rough job, and we've always given the benefit of doubt to police officers, but we have shown that we will make everything right and correct, and we won't put any of the things that may cause our profession to suffer or a police officer to maybe suffer or lose his job in an encounter that he had a few seconds to think about. And so this whole process that we have to look at is that police departments should not be investigating their own solely. It should be a mixture, or it should be given to another entity, maybe a federal entity. The second is a special prosecutor who is not cozy, who we depend on to prosecute other cases on a daily basis and present them and prosecute them, but yet we also give it to them to present and prosecute a police officer, and that's why the system is not working in these cozy relationships. The third is these secretive grand juries that don't release the information to the public. If we're in an age of transparency and we believe what we're doing is right, then we must release that information, and we must show that we are transparent in our actions and everybody is culpable and accountable. The men and women who serve each and every day in a noble way, they have to be given a fair chance, and that fair chance means all sides have to be equalized.
All right, and one last question before we close, and it's a big one. So back to you, Elsie Scott. What about the role of body cameras that everyone's talking about providing local police forces? To what extent will that make a difference in terms of transparency, accountability?
I think that we are going to go in a better direction. It may not be where I want it to be, but I think the fact that the protesters have been out there since August shows that people are concerned. And the fact that the protesters are not just black people, that the protesters are not just college students. You know, we've moved beyond the destructive phase, which happened the night after the grand jury's decision in Ferguson, Missouri, that these are peaceful protests. And then you got a lot of people who are looking at how to reform the system. So I think we will be looking at for some long-term changes. But it does have implications for the whole election process here in this country, that we have to be more serious about who we elect to office and then holding them accountable once we place them in office, recognizing that the mayor has a lot of appointive power in this country, that the county executive has a lot of appointive power, and one of those include appointing the chief of police. And as Deputy Chief Azir had mentioned, we need to look at the command level officials and holding them accountable, the police chiefs and the deputy chiefs. We need to be looking at how do we select them, how do we train them. And on the camera issue, we see that the cameras doesn't always work because different people have different perceptions of what they see. And so I think we can't put all of our emphasis on cameras. Cameras will perhaps play a role in protecting officers as well as citizens. They will add some benefit, but they are just only one small piece of the reform that's needed.
And Malik Aziz, the last word to you with respect to the way forward, accountability, the grand jury system, fostering greater trust between police officers and the community. What are your thoughts?
I think we will have to get back into a real community policing engagement area. We have gotten away from placing police officers and emphasis on talking to people and resolving problems through problem-oriented policing or resolving problems in a neighborhood that's actually generated from the neighborhood itself and not from the police. We need to get back into that zone for a true community policing engagement forum. I believe that the cameras will not be a panacea, but they will add another tool in the tool chest, but better training and better tactics and strategies will be needed going forward. And I think our input into how communities are policed and what they demand or how they demand to be policed will take front and center stage in the future. And the people right now are protesting for that change. They are demanding change. And since this is a government by the people and for the people, then I expect for that commission, that task force, to actually answer the people from a grassroots level, and community police engagement can move forward for a better tomorrow.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Elsie Scott. She's director of the Ron Walters Leadership and Public Policy Center at Howard University here in Washington, and Malik Aziz, deputy chief of the National Black Police Association. Thanks so much to both of you for your terrific insights on this very important topic, which we will continue to discuss in the days ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Aydin Utko, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.